market's overall sense of Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold, explains much of the gap between buoyant stock indexes and lagging economic and policy fundamentals.
Markets are comfortable that despite everything that's going on in Washington, it's Goldilocks for them.
What you're seeing is the last stages of what we call euphoria in a long-term bull market rally. It's the people who have been sitting on the sidelines waiting for that pullback to get in that has just not happened. This market is melting higher, and it's going to continue to do so as we see these positive earnings results come in.
You are trading at all-time highs, and the market is on a knife's edge a little bit. We've been watching the dollar continue lower just this week.
Are you tittering or getting a little nervous, so to speak, about the Federal Reserve again? Because we know now inflation is weak.
So enjoy the journey, but remember that this destination is uncertain as of now.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it was a mixed week for the markets this week. We had the Dow in negative territory, but we have the S&P and the NASDAQ up in record territory, and the Dow earlier in the week had reached record levels. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, Gary Dorsch will be joining me. He still thinks that this market is heading higher. Would not be unusual if the S&P hits 2,500 and the Dow goes to 22,500. You'll want to hear Gary's reasons why. Also joining me on the program will be Kathy Fetke as we talk about real estate. According to Kathy, as she monitors real estate trends around the country, she thinks we're in the ninth inning. So if you're out there buying real estate, whether you're a first-time home buyer or even investing in the sector, you may want to listen to what Kathy has to say about what's going on in the real estate markets. She's not saying a bubble, but pay close attention to what she's going to say. All of that and Ryan Poplava on what moved the markets this week, coming up in Hour 1.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, 2017 has been a year that turned out much differently than anyone had expected. Stocks went up more than anticipated. We entered this year with the Federal Reserve just super intent on raising interest rates. And people prior to the election were predicting the markets would fall. But instead, market values in the U.S. have increased $4 trillion since the election. And it wasn't just the stock investors alone who made money. Bond investors made money, and that wasn't supposed to happen with the Fed raising interest rates. So why is all of this? If we look at the first half of the year and turning our minds toward the third quarter and the fourth quarter, what made money in the beginning of the year and what will most likely make money in the latter part of the year? That's the first topic of conversation on The Big Picture today. And this economic recovery is below the norms of the recoveries of the last 70 years. Most of those recoveries averaged a growth of about 3-4%. This economic recovery did no better than 2%, far below normal, which has puzzled the Fed. And by the way, their forecasts are almost always off the mark. It's puzzled Wall Street. It's puzzled the politicians who are blaming each other for it. So what does all of this mean? And how do we read where things are headed in terms of the rate raising and recession cycles for the future? All of that coming up today on The Big Picture as a part of the Financial Sense News Hour. But first, Ryan Poplava, welcome back for another wrap-up report, where what we do here normally is look at the drivers and catalysts that influence the trading of the financial markets during the last week. S&P 500 closed at 2472, less than half a point lower than its all-time closing high, and that was on Wednesday. So what do you think was at the heart of yet what we would seem to be another bullish week on Wall Street for equities?
Well, John, I think it had to do with, clearly, you know, we're right in the middle of the earnings reports are really kicking off strong this week now. And I'd say on top of that, the resurgence of the strong price performance in those fabulous five stocks out there, the Googles, the Microsofts, Facebook, those were the go-to stocks of the first half of this year. And minor correction when Goldman Sachs came out that one point and said, that they were maybe a little bit overvalued, modest correction in them, and they've been roaring back in the last few weeks. But I mean, there were a lot of possibilities outside of earnings for the market to roll over potentially. There was a few catalysts. One of them was the Senate dropped the healthcare repeal and replace bill. That was quite a disappointment, I'm sure. And then the ECB and the Bank of Japan, so the ECB, European Central Bank, and the Bank of Japan announced this week with a healthy respect right now for possible surprises given the comments from Draghi. A few weeks ago, there was a possibility when we heard from Draghi that maybe they're going to start talking about tapering. Well, that didn't happen. In fact, he did just the opposite and really reaffirmed why they need to keep rates low and why, especially given inflation hasn't come back up. So he kind of backtracked a little bit there. But the other area that could have possibly negatively influenced equities this week was in economics, where we did see some mixed numbers. But you know, John, it's never the news that drives the market. It's always the reaction to news, and that's going to be different from one year to another. But good or bad, we're still in this kind of situation where good is bad and bad is good paradigm, given there's just this addiction to monetary policy accommodation. We haven't left it.
Well, all right, Ryan, are we still in that kind of a mode where good economic reports mean central banks will tighten faster? So that's bad. I mean, that's the result of it. And vice versa, bad economics mean lower for longer.
Unfortunately, John, yeah. You know, the case in point recently, let's look at the news from China this week regarding that point. They announced better than expected GDP. That was about 6.9% year over year. And then they also came out with some other numbers, industrial production, fixed investment, and retail sales, all stronger and beat expectations. So, you know, when you typically see surprises in economic numbers, the markets typically respond very favorably. Not so this time. The Shanghai dropped like 1.4% immediately on that news because, yeah, it was good news, but it's this case of good news is bad because of concerns over tighter margin requirements, tighter monetary policy. And that's just the frame of mind of investors over there. But on the other side of the spectrum, you know, the week, let's look at what happened last week. I look at Friday's trading. The CPI was negative or disappointed. The retail sales figure was also a disappointment. And those seem to kind of confirm Yellen's comments earlier in the week last week about the equal odds over stronger versus less strong economic performance. And essentially, stocks reacted on Friday to that weaker economic news that, hey, we're going to have this lower for longer, as you mentioned, type of Fed speak. And that bit up stocks. The S&P hit fresh highs last Friday on that news.
Well, you know, you'd think that this far after the Great Recession and after Europe's sovereign debt crisis, that by now we would have weaned off this addiction to the punch bowl. I mean, you'd think so. But clearly, monetary policy continues to reign king over all catalysts and why we discuss central bank policy as often as we do here on Financial Sense. So this week, it's always still the reaction to the news. It seems to be the most important. What else happened this week? How about earnings season kicking off?
Yeah, as I mentioned, earnings were right in the mix of it. That's really, I think, the strongest catalyst here this week. Right now, estimates are for a jump of around 6.8% earnings growth for the S&P 500. And when I look at estimates, that's actually up from where they were in June by about a couple tenths of a percent. So, you know, people are looking at the results that are coming out, bidding up expectations of what's going to happen. And mind you, there haven't been too many surprises out there. I mean, we look at the financials last Friday, you'll find that most companies showed that they're beating and maybe have even guided higher for the year. But some have sold off as a result of that good news because, you know, they've already had good performance so far in the last few weeks. Like I said, case in point would be those banks last Friday, some of them guiding higher, but because they've had such a great move, they've sold off. There was a couple of stocks this week where that same situation kind of happened. And then there's Netflix. You know, Netflix actually disappointed on earnings, but was able to show that a whole bunch of new customers were added. So right now the market has been focused on growth. If you look at growth versus value since the beginning of the year, hugely growth has been outperforming. So when we see those kinds of numbers, and again, we're looking at these super tech stocks, these super mega caps where there's been a lot of money's been fluctuating and floating towards, this kind of result really pushed stocks high, and we had a great, great close midweek. That's how we hit those new highs in the S&P. So that's definitely, growth stocks especially, they're kind of what's driving things. So when we hear earnings results that are growth-oriented, case in point like Netflix, that's making things run.
Yeah, understood. All right, going back to your early statement, you said there were other negative catalysts potentially, but they didn't influence the market lower. So what else were you referring to besides the economic numbers?
Well, the economic numbers were mixed this week, but there was a couple key important ones. But let's just look. If we looked at previous corrections in the market, a lot of that was preemptively seen in some of this soft data, like the Philadelphia Fed survey, the Empire Manufacturing survey, these regional surveys we get to see every single month. And then there's also those PMI Purchasing Managers Index data numbers from Europe, China, US, which give us a nice big picture overview of what's going on. They were soft. So Philadelphia Fed survey was soft. Empire Manufacturing was soft. They decelerated, meaning we still have growth, but not as quickly as May. So June, a little bit of a drop there. The other thing was there were some many other positive numbers in housing. Housing data was very strong. Housing starts were up 8.3% looking at their annual rate, and permits were up like 7.4. So great growth in housing here. And that really moved a couple of things. But diving into the numbers, I'd say the biggest growth was into the multi-units. If we have any real estate gurus that are listening in right now, that's the area that has seen the most growth, the most strength. But, it's interesting because I was looking at, we've got some soft data here in Philadelphia Fed Empire. Is that a precursor now of a possible correction this summer? I don't think so, because I just got news this Friday that the conference board's leading economic indicators, Jeffrey Gundlach looks at this. We look at it. We preach it at our strategy meetings, up 4% year over year and is accelerating. So that's actually a really great thing to be seeing on the economic side. I don't know if the market responded to that as much as maybe it should. It should. But on the other flip side, looking at some catalysts, what could be happening here? Energy has been recovering. And if we're talking about inflation, if we're talking about wage inflation, if we're talking about CPI, which is what the market is really focusing on to see if it changes central bank policy right now, energy's been coming up recently on inventory data, as we've been talking about it over the last few weeks. This next week on the 24th, Russia is meeting with some OPEC members. I think actually Libya and Nigeria may also be there in attendance. One of the talks I've been hearing behind the scenes is Libya and Nigeria, they're right now exempt from all the cuts that they've been making. Net result, they're actually producing more despite their cuts over the last year. Are they going to rein in Libya and Nigeria? That will be very interesting to hear next week. That could be a catalyst next week. But overall, John, just look at the positives and the negatives. If you recall back in the first quarter, we talked a lot about fiscal policy and Trump's goals to deregulate, create more infrastructure spending, and repeal healthcare and cut taxes. So some lofty goals there, obviously, now as we're looking back another almost 7 months into this year. And, I saw some strategists say there was a premium in the S&P's valuations back in the first quarter of around like 1x earnings. Well, this week, again, talking about possible disappointments, the Senate, like I said, decided not to vote on the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act. They talked about doing a repeal and postpone, whereby they would repeal now and then discuss an alternative over the next 2 years. And I like that. I like that. Hey, let's not just kind of crunch something in here, just pass it and not really think twice about it. It's good. Let's take some time to think about it and come to the table, compromise, etc. But Mitch McConnell said he'd put it for a vote next week. But, honestly, it's highly unlikely that it's going to happen, because already three Republicans are calling it irresponsible to cut right now and then wait 2 years for another replacement. And I totally agree. You can't just like, we're just going to go back and cancel what we did over the last few years. Everyone's already getting used to it with the Affordable Care Act, with, the healthcare websites for signing up, et cetera, et cetera. Millions have signed on. You can't just say, sorry, and then wait another 2 years. So anyways, overall, on the fiscal side of things, just a really big disappointment. And it's funny listening into Jamie Dimon, Morgan Stanley, last week on the earnings call, talking about just the dysfunction there. And he essentially said, looking at growth, He said it would be so much stronger had we made intelligent decisions and were there no gridlock. And he's referring to Washington. He's referring to fiscal policy right now. And yes, investors are still hopeful towards seeing maybe some unification over taxes, but right now, there's really little confidence in fiscal policy. And that's unfortunate because the market really started off on a strong note the first half of this year based on those possible catalysts.
Yeah, and you're right about the Affordable Health Care Act, because the first so-called sin of the Affordable Health Care Act was that they did ram it through. Remember that? It ran from what?
They did.
The debate May to July, and everybody was
trying to... Let's pass it and read it, what it says, and figure it out later.
And figure it out later, right, which was dumb. But now that you've established a system out here, and there are a lot of people who had pre-existing conditions that have benefited from this, others, of course, wound up with much higher premiums, but you just can't create another vacuum for 2 years, leaving everybody in limbo. And if you're going to do something, for Pete's sake, think it out this time.
Yeah.
You know, and what we really needed was healthcare reform, not more healthcare problems. And that's what we've been given here as a result of that.
Yep.
So when I heard all this, well, we're just going to repeal it. Oh, really? Then what do you do with this vacuum you've now created in the midst
exactly.
of it? So, okay. So the key drivers right now are slow and steady growth, and that keeps rates low. Central banks are accommodative. Earnings continue to grow. And that was part of the story back at the end of 2016, as well as the Trump trade that helped propel stocks higher. So thus far, they only have half the story without the fiscal stimulus. It's like I've always said every week, it's interesting times, but I appreciate your fiscal sagacity. How's that? And hopefully we'll have you back. Now you go run for the dictionary now. Go.
Yeah, I like that. That was a good word.
Go figure out what it is I just said.
And then we'll all do that.
Yeah. And then we'll see you back next week, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Sounds good, John. Good to talk to you.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
We're seeing the very early innings of monetary settings moving from exceptionally accommodative to neutral, but by the spring of next year, we would expect that threshold to be passed and we'll be moving into outright restrictive territory. And so this unusual window for profit margins where pricing power is outpacing the expansion of the cost structure will end.
Well, stock markets continue to head higher. Investors have to be pretty happy with this kind of market as the Dow and the S&P head to new record territory. Joining us on the program is Gary Dorsch. And Gary, let's begin with the stock market because we are at record levels. I don't care whether you're looking at the S&P, the Dow, or the NASDAQ, they all keep heading higher. What's driving it? Is it corporate earnings, fundamentals, or is it just old-fashioned plenty of money printing?
Well, it is a situation of a lot of money chasing fewer and fewer stocks, at least here in the United States. And here we are on the close on Thursday afternoon with the Dow at 21,600 area and the S&P at 2475. That's just 25 points now from the 2500 level and the NASDAQ hitting record highs as well. It is a story of shrinking supply of equities and massive supply of new monies being injected into the world markets. And that's really what the major fundamentals have been. Traders have been focused like a laser on the growth of the balance sheets of the Bank of Japan and the European Central Bank, which together combined are printing and injecting about $130 billion worth of euros and yen into the world markets every month. And on top of that, we have other central banks which are printing their local currencies to keep their currencies on an even keel with their competitors, such as in India And in Korea and Switzerland, their supply of foreign currency reserves are also hitting record highs. And this, I think, is the main fuel that is lifting the market higher. And, of course, negative interest rates in Europe. Two-year yields in Germany, Italy, France, Switzerland, all below zero. And even here in the United States, although the Fed's been raising the Fed funds rate, and the two-year yield here in the U.S. at 1.35%, that's still below the so-called inflation rate of 1.6%. So on a real adjusted, inflation-adjusted rate, the U.S. has negative rates as well. And then I think finally, the other major factor, if we look at the real big picture, I saw a very interesting statistic a few weeks ago. There was about 7,200 different companies that were listed on the various U.S. exchanges 20 years ago, including the small caps and small board NASDAQ, but also the larger ones. And over the last 20 years, the number of listed shares on the exchanges has dropped in half to just under 3,600 shares. And another statistic came out showing that over the last 8 years, S&P 500 companies have reduced the supply of their outstanding stock through buybacks by about 18%. So shrinking supply of equities plus massive liquidity injections, that simple formula leads to higher and higher stock prices. And that's about all you need to know. If you use the old playbook, it doesn't work in many cases. That playbook, at least, that was good until 2008. We are divorced from economics. Bad economic data can lead to higher stock prices because it leads to the idea that central banks will continue to print money. And so bad news on the economy could be good news on the stock market. And that's a different way of looking at things than what prevailed before 2008.
Let me stop you there, Gary, because this is something that I have observed as well. I saw that article on we no longer have a Wilshire 5000. But one of the interesting things about this bull market, which we're now in our ninth year, typically you at some point, maybe it's the final stages, you have individual investors come in. This stock market has been driven by central bank buying and by companies buying their own stock to the tune of almost $500 billion a year. So in one sense, doesn't this make this more of an institutional market because the little guy isn't invested in this market? If he is, it's only through his 401k program. But this certainly isn't like the 90s where the little guy had his day trading account and he was buying individual stocks or ETFs. If anything, if he's doing anything in the stock market, it's in passive investing in index funds, which further drives the markets higher.
That's correct. I think I saw an analysis that approximately 60% of retail accounts now are pretty much focusing just on ETFs, and they're happy to stay even or pick various sectors of the market. And another report showed over 60% of trading in the stock market is now conducted by computer algorithms, automatic trading, divorced from human logic, and it's impossible to really compete with these algorithms that can analyze up to about 140 bits of data at a moment's notice and spit out buy and sell orders. So how does the little guy contend with such an environment? And even institutions are laying off a lot of their staff and are just going to computers to handle their trading and their analysis. That's where technology has had its impact, not only on the shale oil market, but also in trading in the equity market. So at the end of the day, the little guy can invest his money through passive investing and can do very well and just has to place his faith that the central banks cannot allow these markets to fail and that they'll come to the rescue as they have over and over. And this year in particular has been something that we haven't seen in decades. Typically, we have a pullback of at least 5% in the S&P at least three times per year on average. So far in the first 7 months, we haven't had a single pullback of 5%. Biggest pullback was about 2.8%. And therefore, the power behind this market is unlike anything that has been seen in decades, where you can't even get a decent dip to buy. You just have to buy high and and hope that it goes higher.
Yeah, buy high and buy higher. But, you know, we all know that central banks are not infallible. They eventually break things. They raise rates, whether it's the Fed or it's going to be the ECB with taper. But eventually, Gary, they're going to raise them to the point because, as you and I know, there's a lot more outstanding debt. But you bring up an interesting point about the stock market, but I think it could be equally said about the bond market. In fact, Bill Gross came out the other day and he said you can't use the inverted yield curve as a predictor of recessions anymore because you have large central bank buying of securities which are suppressing rates. And I want to go there next. Let's talk about the 10-year Treasury note, which has been in a very narrow band between, let's say, 2.1% and 2.5%. It's been there for almost a good, 9 months now?
Yeah, it has. And you're correct. Even though the Fed has been raising short-term interest rates, the Fed has raised short-term interest rates 1% since December of 2015, hiking the Fed funds rate from 1/8 to 1.125. But during that time period, the 10-year Treasury yield was about unchanged. That's kind of similar to the conundrum that Mr. Greenspan ran into back in 2004, 2005, when he was raising short-term rates and the long rates were not going up nearly as much as the short rates and eventually led to an inverted yield curve. And he also said that the yield curve had lost its forecasting ability. It wasn't what it used to be. And so Fed officials dismissed the inverted yield curve in 2006 and 2007. And then, of course, the bear market hit in, a year or so later. There is a lag between an inverted yield curve and a bear market of about 1 year to a year and a half. The U.S. bond market does not exist in a vacuum. It's part of the international marketplace. And so if the Bank of Japan is keeping the Japanese 10-year yield locked at 0% through unlimited buying, and now Bank of Japan owns 44% of the entire Japanese bond market, and the ECB is going to perhaps roll back its or even taper its QE injections next year. Even if it does begin to taper QE next year and actually mothballs it and ends it in September, as has been speculated, I figure they can still inject about another 500 billion euros into the markets and still be a major buyer. So they'll keep the foreign rates down. And then U.S. rates look attractive relative to low rates overseas, and so buyers come in to buy U.S. bonds simply because it looks more attractive. That's just the type of marketplace that we're dealing in. So, correct. If the Fed raises the short-term rates too much more, it'll probably continue to contract the yield curve. And if that's the case, maybe the banking stocks will underperform the market. They just won't do as well as the broad market due to a narrower profit margin on lending. So that will probably limit the Fed's ability to raise short-term rates if the foreign banks are not going along. And in fact, we heard Janet Yellen shocking the market last week, saying that she thought the neutral rate, the ultimate rate where the Fed would want to get to, is not 3%, as has been long telegraphed by the Fed, but rather closer to where we are now. And futures markets say the Fed will only raise the Fed funds rate 1%, maybe one time this year and one time next year, and to finish the rate hiking at 1.625. And that's still super low. So if you're an equity investor, you don't really have to worry about the Fed. I think the big question would be, as far as the yield curve, what will happen if the Fed begins quantitative tightening and starts to reduce the size of its balance sheet? That's a much more potent weapon than rate increases. Will the Fed actually begin quantitative tightening and allow the runoff of its bonds as it is threatening, or will it get cold feet at the last minute and delay it? And in any event, we'll have a new Fed chairman in about 6 months, and that person may have a different view about quantitative tightening than the current board. So that's a big wild card.
Well, let's talk about where this ends, because we know just like in the 90s when Greenspan was flooding the markets with liquidity, he did it after the peso crisis in 94. He did it in Asia. He did it with long-term capital management. He did it with Y2K. And we know that eventually prices get to some level and there's some event, in this case, interest rates hikes, and who knows what that could be. But we know that stocks aren't just going to keep going up, 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 and up, no matter how much liquidity. At some point, I don't know, know what that event will be. Maybe it won't be something that the Federal Reserve does. Maybe it's something that another central bank does, or it's some kind of political event that brings this to an end. But right now, it seems like it's party on.
Well, we've had two major bear markets in the last 17 years. They were both precipitated by the Fed raising the Fed funds rate and inverting the yield curve. And the Fed was raising rates because inflation was elevated and inflation was a problem. Other central banks were tightening along with the Fed. It wasn't just one central bank. It was the Bank of England, the European Central Bank. Even the Bank of Japan unwound its QE program in 2006. First time and only time that's ever been done. Central banks in the emerging markets were joining in on the rate hiking. That's when we had oil hitting 145. That's a barrel. That's a much different scenario than today. So will the event be a tightening of monetary policies? That would be about one possible risk factor, and that doesn't look like a major risk. And then the other possibility for a decline in the market would be we just get overvalued on a price-to-earnings ratio. P.E. ratio of the S&P, 25 times earnings, it's trailing earnings. That's historically high. That's where we are now. And yet people are afraid to short sell the market because it just keeps going higher.
Let me throw a caveat out there, because I read last year we had $500 billion go into index funds, either index ETFs or index mutual funds. This year it's supposed to go up by 60% to over $800 billion. And just as you were making reference to earlier, Gary, that a lot of this algorithmic trading that we're seeing today, there's computers making decisions. There's no human individuals that are making these decisions. Likewise, when all this money floods into a passive index fund, the index manager doesn't think and say, well, Amazon is selling at 200 times earnings. That's a little expensive for me. If you're a NASDAQ fund and you get $100 million, 12% of that money is going into Amazon regardless. So there is no thinking beyond this. Can't this go much, much higher than what we're currently thinking because of the way this market is being funneled, not only by liquidity from central banks, but also from the passive investing that is going into these index funds is fueling these, you know, Amazon's over $1,000 a share now. Who knows? Maybe it'll be $2,000 a share by the time this is done.
It's a definite possibility. We are in a hyper-inflated psychology in the marketplace, and through passive investing, that does have the impact that you're discussing. So if I had to guess what would stop this market, I would suggest, yes, it can go up another 5-10% over the next several months. There'll be pullbacks of 1-2%, I suppose, along the way, maybe 3 if we get a real severe situation. But, you know, the dynamics are the buybacks, the money printing, and the ultra-low interest rates. And at the end of the day, whenever we do see a little bit of a scary pullback, the selling just seems to dry up, and then market turns around, and we go back to focusing on those other three factors I just mentioned. So I think if we're going to ever see a bear market again, or at least even a correction of 10% or more, it would have to be some crisis overseas that nobody can anticipate, maybe a major geopolitical crisis. But beyond something like that, I have to see the ECB shut down its money printing operation and the Bank of Japan shut down their operations. Once that happens, then I think the market, you know, can drop 10-20%. So until that day arrives, I would not short sell the market. And this buy on the dip psychology, I think, will continue to prevail. And this market will go higher, and we'll just have to see, you know, where the ultimate top is. And although prices could get so ridiculous on a P.E. ratio basis that, you know, they could just sell off on correcting the P.E.s back to something towards sanity again.
Gary, final question. In this whole complex, we've got bond yields that have been stabilized and suppressed by central bank buying. Likewise, we have the same thing occurring in the stock market. Let's talk about commodities, two in particular, oil and gold. What's your thoughts there?
These markets have missed all the money printing. Gold has always been traditionally the refuge for those who were betting on monetary inflation, and they're very frustrated that it didn't work out for them. Even investors in India, the second largest buyers of gold in the world, according to an article I recently read, have decided that buying the local stock market was a better bet than buying gold. And that's been the big shift in psychology over the last several years. Oddly enough, the gold market is still very much a function of U.S. interest rates. When it looks like U.S. interest rates are coming down, the gold market goes up. And if the longer-term interest rates go up, the gold market goes down. So gold is very much focused on where longer-term interest rates are going to go. So I don't see the interest rates going down much at all from here. With the 10-year at 2.25, I think the low would be about 2.1 and the high would be about 2.5 to 2.6 for the rest of this year. That would suggest gold will trade between its recent low of 210 and 1300 if the interest rate gets down towards 2% on the 10-year. That's going to be hard to do. So I would put a lid on gold. My top would be about 275, with support it at 1210. So it's going to be, I don't see any major move there. I think most of the action now is in the stock market. And interest rates are going to be relatively flat. It's going to take the ECB a long time to start moving on tapering. The earliest they will start is January, so they'll still keep the lid on the long-term rates until then. We may see the long-term rates start to move up next year once they begin to taper, and then, oddly enough, the gold market may go down if rates do go up. On the oil market, of course, it's supply and demand, and although OPEC has cut its oil production along with Russia and others outside of OPEC by 1.8 million barrels a day, they've been stymied by a 1 million increase in U.S. shale oil production since June of last year. And there's been big increases in oil output out of Libya, about 400,000 barrels a day, and still going higher. And Nigeria also increasing its oil output by several hundred thousand barrels, and that has negated the cuts by OPEC. The futures market has a pretty good handle on where all this will end. And looking at the U.S. oil at 46.73 in the spot market, the December contract for this year is only a dollar higher, and the December 2018 contract is $2 higher than the spot market at 48.79. So the futures traders see oil staying below 50 between now and the end of next year. Many shale oil companies have become increasingly efficient and have been able to reduce their break-even costs into the 30s, $35, $40 barrel range. So they're actually making money at these prices. And so for that reason, they have the capacity to increase production by about another million barrels a day and very quickly as well. They can get a well up and pumping within a matter of weeks nowadays, which has really shocked the OPEC cartel. So for that reason, I don't see oil going above 50 between now and the end of the year. With 45 is the base level, and so that would be my forecast between now and the end of the year.
So, Gary, given that markets are being fueled by liquidity, companies are buying back stock, investors are putting their money in index funds, which are buying more stock, I assume you stay invested in this kind of market, and it would be very dangerous to try to short it.
I would agree with that. I'll say that the Dow Industrials currently at 21,600 will attempt to reach 22,500 by the end of the year. That'll take the S&P above 2,500, and the NASDAQ market could be the strongest of all, given its growth prospects as faster-growing companies. They also have the possibility of getting repatriated money from overseas if Congress does allow for a lower tax rate on repatriating about $2.5 to $3 trillion sitting overseas. Reports I've read that at least 80% of that money will go into buybacks and increasing dividends, and most of that money is held by the big NASDAQ giants along with medical companies. So that's another big wave of money to come into this market. Those buybacks, however, don't buy as much stock as they used to. They're not as potent a weapon, but they're in there buying on all dips, and I think that's one reason why we don't see much of a dip. Corporations are coming in. But I would say for a more cautious investor such as myself, I would stay with the ETFs. Buying individual stocks is still a very risky business. If you buy the wrong one, such as like a Macy's or even Home Depot today dropped 5% because Amazon is moving into their turf. You can get nasty pullbacks on a daily basis with individual stocks. So I would stick with sector funds or ETFs for better diversification.
All right, Gary, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, tell them how they can do so, please.
Well, my website is at globalmoneytrends.com, so you can go there, see some articles that I posted on the internet, and also I have a link to a Twitter page that I update during the week. You can visit me on Twitter as well, and you can find all that information at globalmoneytrends.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program is Jason Shingler from the law firm Warden Williams. And Jason, let's kind of set the stage here for many individuals in the United States, a husband and wife with proper trust planning. That's pretty much all you need to do because, as I understand, the exemption is $5.49 million, almost $5.5 million, and that's indexed to inflation. So for the average married couple, for let's say they set up a living trust, that's $11 million you don't pay estate taxes on.
That's correct. I mean, we could start by just talking about how the estate tax situation works in the United States, and you sort of summed it up. There's an estate tax exclusion, which means that everybody can leave a certain amount of money to whoever they'd like, estate tax-free. Currently, that level is, like you said, $5.49 million per individual. And if you're married, you each have $5.49 million. And we introduced a new concept called portability in 2011 that says that if one spouse passes away and the surviving spouse files a Form 706 estate tax return, then they will actually inherit their deceased spouse's exclusion. So for most people, they'll have $10.98 million of exclusion amount before they ever have an estate tax problem. And as you noted, that's the index for inflation as well, so it will continue to creep up over the years. So for the majority of people in the United States, we just don't do much estate tax planning anymore, but it does come up from time to time, and one of the ways to take care of an estate tax situation is by using some life insurance strategies.
Well, it's no secret the price of real estate has been going up after so many years in a downturn. Over the last couple of years, prices have been going up in every single area across the country for the most part. Is real estate heading for another bubble, or are there other circumstances driving up prices? Joining us from Real Wealth Network is Kathy Fetke. Kathy, I want to start out with a couple housing reports that we got this month. The NAHB Housing Market Index fell to 64 in July. Above 50 is obviously optimistic, but all of its components from present sales, future sales, and buyer traffic all fell month over month. Should we make too much out of that? Because at the same time, we had better housing starts. So what's going on here in real estate?
Yeah, it can be pretty confusing. I think overall, builders are having a tough time bringing in inventory that people can afford. And there's several reasons for that. Land prices have gone up. Costs of material have gone up. Labor costs have gone up tremendously. There is a real dearth of construction workers, about 200,000 jobs needed, and just not the qualified contractors to fill those jobs. So all of that is driving costs up for builders. And so they have to stay within a threshold of affordability or their inventory will just sit. They don't want to go through, they can't go through another meltdown like they did before, which really virtually wiped out builders. So they're cautious. They realize that in some markets they may be reaching that threshold of affordability and they don't want to take another risk. Yet at the same time, there's no inventory. So that may be why sales are still happening, you know, in spite of the risk there of building inventory that people may not be able to afford in the future.
You know, two things I have heard about this housing recovery that make it a little bit different than those that preceded it. One is there isn't the excess inventory that we saw going into the financial crisis. Because I can remember here, Kathy, you'd go into some of these developments and the builders would have phase two and three going with a lot of speculative homes. I have not seen that in this recovery. That's number one. And number two, as you just expressed, a lot of builders, I have several contractors as clients, they're having a hard time procuring qualified workers to get the job done.
Yeah, you know, our current administration hasn't necessarily helped with that. We need to welcome our workers, and that may be a political statement, but when we have 200,000 openings and we're talking about creating jobs, why aren't we training these people and why aren't Americans taking these jobs? You know, I think they're hard to put a roof on. You may hear some pounding in the background because that's happening next door. It's hot and it's a difficult work and not everybody wants to do it. So builders are finding they have to pay more to get people to do the hard labor, and that's driving prices up. So, you know, there's always a positive and negative to anything. That means if you own an existing property, your values are probably going up because it's costing more to create what you may already have. If you don't own property, it may be frustrating to watch prices go up, but that is part of the inflation we're experiencing as a result of lack of inventory.
So is this something that is confined to, let's say, custom contractors? I mean, what are the big builders doing? I mean, I'm talking about the Toll Brothers and some of the others, because I know here in California, it is very difficult sometimes to get building permits, to get approval. You have to go through zoning. You have to go through environmental regulations, which is making it much more difficult. How much of this is governmental in many cases like it is in California?
Oh, so much is, and it's frustrating. I'm a builder too. We raise lots of capital from our investment group for building residential because we know that's the need. And what's frustrating is you know there's a need there, but you can't bring the product online. There's so many things that stop. We have a project of 4,200 homes in Tampa where housing is desperately needed, and we're several years delayed on that because of the government. So it has a lot to do with government regulations, but at the same time, we don't want to have happen what happened in London, where that terrible travesty where an apartment building blew up because there was a lack of regulation there and a certain siding was put on these high-rise buildings that's flammable. And many people were hurt and killed from that. So obviously we need regulation and we don't want builders building things that aren't safe for people. But sometimes it goes to the extreme, and that's what we're experiencing in our projects. Is I'll give you an example. Code changed in California around oak trees. So you can't have, I think it's doubled where your septic can be away from an oak tree. Now, what's the purpose of that? I'm sure somebody had a good reason, but that means that a whole lot of people have to change their plans.
So when you take places like California where you have zoning issues, let's talk about something else that is different in this market. Because as you brought up, builders are having a hard time bringing product to the market and staying within a certain monetary threshold to make it affordable. In the last run-up in real estate that we saw in the last decade, homes got bigger. We were building McMansions. You don't see that as much this time around. It seems to me that the builders are building much smaller product. They're getting more innovative in their design and trying to make the most out of a smaller space to keep the price down.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Warren Buffett's big news a couple months ago was that he invested in the tiny home movement, and that could be a big solution. I personally live in a, I don't know if you'd call it a tiny home, but it's pretty little. And, you know, Rich and I bought a one-bedroom, one-bath. That's what we live in Malibu because we want to live here, and it's expensive, so we live small. But that is something that I think more and more of the younger generation's interested in, and it's actually kind of funny having such a small house, and we kind of built out the garage so our daughter would have her space. These kids with mansions, they love coming to our house because people can find each other. It's kind of hard to find family members in those mansions. When you're in a small house, you have more community, and that's nice. So the problem with any growth is that you have a lot of factors. We've got population growth, but do we have water? Do we have power? Do we have the things necessary, the infrastructure, the roads, the traffic, the parking to be able to handle all these people? So, you know, it's not that easy for anyone to get new housing up and running. That's one of the reasons when we invested in Texas, people would say, oh my gosh, there's so much land in Texas, prices will never go up. Well, that turned out to be wrong. We invested right before prices went up because we knew the infrastructure that was coming in and the jobs that were going in. But you can't just put up a subdivision and expect there to be water and electrical and all the utilities. It takes time. So that's kind of where we're at. We're growing and we don't have the inventory, the housing inventory to keep up.
Now, what about, there have been some articles recently in the Wall Street Journal talking about bubble-like prices in our own state here at California. I think last time you were on the program, we were talking about the area of Silicon Valley right around San Francisco, where prices and even some prices in Los Angeles around Beverly Hills were getting to the point where they were bubble-like, I think almost like $1,000 per foot or sometimes even more.
Yeah, there's no question in my mind that the San Francisco Bay Area is in a bubble. A lot of people would disagree with me because it is really the economic engine, perhaps, of the entire U.S. with all that tech development. And, you know, you can't help but see that Apple and LinkedIn, and this is the tech center of the world. And so most people think it will never be affected. And I often hear people say it isn't affected by downturns, but that's just not true. All you have to do is look, Google it yourself and look at property values in the Silicon Valley, in many areas, prices were cut in half. So to think that it's not possible for a downturn to come even to the San Francisco Bay Area is just naive and not based on reality or history. So one example of that is, again, my company is we're building in Reno because we know that many of those Silicon Valley companies are seeing that there's better tax incentives than Nevada. Land is cheaper. It's easier to build. They can pay their employees enough money that they can live comfortably. That's just not the case in Silicon Valley. They can't even find places for their employees to live. So when a market gets so overpriced, companies tend to realize this isn't going to work and they're going to move to cheaper areas. That's how it's always been. So things change. You can't look at the past to determine the future. You have to really look at what's happening and where the trends are and where the path of progress is and get in front of that. That's how you can profit in any market, whether it's an up or down market.
Now, do you find other areas of the country that are experiencing, let's say, they're driven by some particular industry, and in the case of Silicon Valley, it's technology. Are there other areas around the U.S. that have become overpriced in many ways, like what we saw in the last real estate run-up, where you had areas like California, you had Las Vegas, you had Phoenix, you had Florida that were overpriced? Are you seeing any of that transpire in this upturn?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, back then, those areas, Las Vegas, Phoenix, that was a lot of investor money. The markets there were booming pretty much from construction, just trying to keep up with California investors buying, you know, 5 to 10 investment properties in those areas. And of course, that didn't work out for anyone. And the same is true for Florida. Some of those markets where you could legitimately say, hey, there's real jobs in these areas, and that's what's driving growth. And that would be Seattle, Portland, Denver, perhaps Miami. These areas are past any highs they've ever had. So, you know, again, some people will say, well, you know, these loans are, they're good loans out there. A lot of people paid cash. There's plenty of jobs. It's a millennial magnet. You know, in Denver specifically, you can go and have free marijuana, not free, but legal. And so there's different reasons why these areas are booming. But again, you always have to look at the fundamentals and ask yourself if it's possible, if it's even possible for it to continue. And historically, I should say history teaches us that things go up and down, and that every single time they go up, people forget they come down. And every time they go down, people forget they go up again. And so people often, I would say the majority, the masses get it backwards, and they buy at the peak and they sell at the trough because they forget that things change. So I would just be cautious. I'm not saying that there'll be a burst of a bubble. Things could just stay where they are, but I would never buy anything today thinking that things are going to continue the way they are. In other words, if Denver prices have doubled or tripled in the last decade, don't expect that to happen again in the next decade. It may or it may not, but the chances are that it would not. It has to stabilize at some point. So we're at the ninth inning, many people say, in the economy, and that usually means there's going to be a slowdown around the corner. Could be 3 years from now, but it's still important to prepare and just have that in the back of your mind so that you're not investing in something or buying a property or investing in anything that where you may be paying top dollar just to see those values go down in a year or two.
Kathy, how much of this is being directed sometimes like companies? You mentioned that from Silicon Valley, a lot of these tech companies I know are moving to places like Reno where the cost of living is much cheaper, the taxes are non-existent, everything is lower to operate. I know companies have been moving to Texas out of California because the cost of doing business, I think, what was it earlier this year? Nestle just closed their final factory here in California. Toyota has moved out where it's gotten so expensive. So when a company like Toyota or let's say Nestle moves a factory to North Carolina or moves a factory to Austin, Texas, doesn't that create real estate opportunities because it's driven by job growth with the company coming in, creating a market, creating those jobs that create the demand for housing?
You have just identified my obsession. That's what I do and that's what I love. I love finding out where the jobs are going before anybody else finds out. And then we buy properties in those areas. If the locals don't know something is happening in their area, they just are going to sell at today's prices. Or in some cases, these are somewhat depressed or affordable areas. That's why businesses are moving there. You know, an example, well, again, would be Texas. Back in 2004 and 5, we knew there was a bubble in California. We were telling people it's a great time to sell and exchange your property tax deferred for property in Texas where we knew jobs were headed. And sure enough, it's had the highest job and population growth in the country as a result. And yet, you know, people could sell their California property 10 years ago for top dollar, say $1 million, and go to Texas and buy 7 or 8 brand new properties in great neighborhoods, buy new jobs and jobs that are there to stay, and quintuple their cash flow and experience appreciation. So, you know, we're constantly looking to rinse and repeat. Sell at the peak. If it's in a bubble or it looks or smells or acts like a bubble, maybe it's a good time to sell and exchange. And now we still have this wonderful tax law that allows us to exchange property tax deferred, and that's a huge benefit.
So as you look at real estate, let's talk about other areas of real estate. We've been talking mainly here about single family homes. What about multi-family units like apartments? I know there for a while during the housing crisis and afterwards where a lot of people lost their homes, inventory of homes became unaffordable, and all of a sudden these people were thrown out and the rental market got to be hot. What's going on in rental properties, such as, let's say, multi-unit apartments?
You know, it just depends on the area. There's certainly parts of the country that have not recovered from the recession. And it's not just the recession. It's a change in the economy that, boy, we better get prepared for. We're about to go through probably the biggest transformation of a way of life over the next 5 years than probably when they discovered the wheel, right, or something. I mean, things are changing. And if you can't keep up with it, you're not going to succeed. And metro areas won't succeed. Businesses don't succeed that don't keep up with the changes. And the changes are going to come rapid fire. So, you know, we've got to pay attention to where's the growth and invest in that and get out of the stuff that isn't keeping up. So there are parts of the country, I mean, I'll tell you a horror story. We bought an apartment building in outside of Indianapolis, but an hour out, and that area is just not recovering. So we haven't seen rents go up. Well, so many areas have seen apartment rents soaring. So we kind of made a mistake on that apartment. But, you know, it's decent cash flow. It's just not, we're not experiencing what you might be experiencing again in some of these Texas markets or just areas where there's job growth. Another example is Cleveland, Ohio. That's an area that has become a medical hub internationally. It's almost like the whole downtown is medical research, universities, state-of-the-art hospitals. And we have an aging population, 70-something million baby boomers who are going to be looking for medical care over the coming years. So being in medical areas is smart. University towns, smart. But being in, I'm just going to throw out something political, but coal, is this something that is coal our future? And so some areas are going to not make it if they're not keeping up. And we need to stay out of those areas.
Have you found traditionally, as you take a look at the population grid in this country, it's heavily concentrated on the West and the East Coast. Are these typically the areas you find where real estate values tend to get overvalued as we have here? I mean, I don't care if you're talking about Silicon Valley. It's the same thing, Kathy, down here from San Diego, going all the way up to Los Angeles and all the way up the coast.
Well, you know, I imagine back in the days when, you know, you were living in a tent and migrating and so forth, people always gravitate to where it's most desirable, where the weather is good, where there's beauty, where there's water, resources, and people stay out of other parts of the country. Australia, for example, they only have people living on the coasts. There's almost nothing in between the coasts. Now, in America, we've done a little better. We've developed middle America. But, you know, again, people are going to go where the weather is mild, where there's jobs, where there's population, where there's resources. And so the coasts have always boomed. And when the coasts boom, that means that people are coming out of middle America to the boom. And then when that boom busts, they tend to go back. So there's an ebb and flow that happens between the coasts. Now, Florida has kind of been an exception where prices have not taken off the way they have in other coasts. I mean, if you compare, let's say, Orlando, and if you go straight across the map, there's no way the properties in Orlando are anywhere near as expensive as in California. But that's changing. It's because so many baby boomers are realizing they do want to retire near the coast, near the ocean, warm climate, but they can't afford to retire in California. So they're heading over to that side of the country. And so I think we're going to continue to see prices rise over there as long as it doesn't end up underwater. Just kidding. Some people are predicting, but the same with Georgia, Texas. A lot of these baby boomers are looking for an affordable but nice vacation-like place to retire. And you have the other huge population, which is the millennials, and they're just looking for jobs, entry-level jobs. So anywhere you can find an affordable place with entry-level jobs, those areas are going to boom. And that's why Detroit is on the map for us at Real Wealth Network. I know it doesn't sound like the sexiest city, but millennials like it because the whole downtown has been revitalized by three billionaires who have each put in a couple billion to revitalize Detroit after its bankruptcy. And, you know, people can live there for cheap, and it's become kind of a cool place in parts of it. And yet you can buy a house for under $100,000. You can buy a house for about $70,000, $60,000 there. And that's affordable for almost anyone.
Wow. So in conclusion, Kathy, as you look at the real estate market, you say that, and I agree with you, we're closer to the end of a business cycle. The Fed is in the process of raising interest rates, and we know eventually what that leads to. The business cycle comes to an end. The economy goes into a recession. So you made a comment earlier that we're closer to the ninth inning. So what would you be doing if you were a real estate? Well, let's take two people. Let's take a first-time home buyer or a real estate investor.
That's such a great question. And, you know, there's just, I think our country and the world is probably split and divided right down the middle as to whether there's going to be a recession or a boom. Again, half the voting population thinks there's going to be a boom with the new administration, and half the population thinks the opposite. That's at least my take on it. So I have been telling people to play defensively as if either option could happen. And so if you were making decisions today and you knew that historically, every decade, and certainly in the first term of most presidents, there's a recession. And if you knew that's a possibility, what might you do differently? Again, back in 2006, I didn't know. I had no idea we were heading into such a massive housing collapse. What I did know is that I was a loan broker at the time, and I knew those loans didn't make sense and that people couldn't afford them, and I knew there was going to be problems, and I knew that California was way overpriced because people didn't actually have to qualify for the loans, but that someday they would have to and there would be a problem. So I kind of put that together, and not knowing that we were going to have such a major collapse, I advised a lot of people just to do something different that would be positive no matter what. And so selling at the peak then and exchanging for five or six properties in Texas that are brand new and growing areas, if there was a recession, they would be okay. And if there was a boom, they'd be okay. It didn't matter. So those are the decisions we have to make. What if? Just ask what if. If there was a recession, would you buy that house and do a full gut renovation that takes 2 years? I don't know. What if there's a recession in 6 months? You might want to stick to short-term renovations if you're doing a flip. If you're doing buy and hold, you need to consider, if you're investing in real estate, most Californians think, I'm buying real estate for the up. You know, they've seen their friends double or triple their money just this decade, just in the last, in some cases, 3 years, they've seen people, you know, become enormously wealthy from buying property, and they want that. So they think they can buy today and get that, and that it just doesn't work that way. So if you're investing in property, don't do it for the appreciation. do it for the long term, that if you can hold that property, it will probably be worth a lot more in the future, but you need to hold it through any down. So that means if you're renting it, you need to calculate the returns as if there were rent decreases, not just increases. I see that all the time. People put together their pro formas and all they put in there is appreciation numbers and rent increases. What if it's the opposite? Just as long as you can withstand a downturn, you'll be okay.
I would suspect withstanding a downturn would also depend on the rate of financing you get on a mortgage and how much leverage you have. Kathy, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more about Real Wealth Network and what you do at your firm, how could they do so?
It's so easy. I'm kind of everywhere, but realwealthnetwork.com is our website. You can join there for free and just get an enormous amount of information on market timing and the best markets for investing and how to do it and all that. I also have the Real Wealth Show on iTunes that you can subscribe to, and I do a daily show there on iTunes.
Lots of exciting information coming up in the next hour on the Financial Sense News Hour. 2017 was a year that turned out to be, well, a lot more different than anyone anticipated. They expected stocks to go down after the elections. In reality, they went up. But not just that, bonds went up and things were doing strange things. Nobody's complaining because it's been good for the markets. But why is that? And by the way, what are the indicators telling us about the next possible recession? All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.